Why We Bleep is sponsored by Signal Sounds. Take me to the distant past. That's what my ex-wife said during our divorce proceedings. After I'd blown through our collective savings on Eurorack modular synthesizers and other musical doodads purchased from Signal Sounds. It was all reasonably priced. I just bought a lot of it. And that gives me an idea for... I'm fairly sure that at this stage my obscenely large modular cabinet of flashing lights and wires must surely be capable of time travel. After all, time always did seem to pass more quickly when I played it at home versus on stage. And so, I shall patch the outputs back into the inputs and use it to travel to the past, to when I still had money and a wife, and I'd do it all differently. Who am I even kidding? Nope, I'll march myself right back into signalsounds.com and do it again. They've got a brand new website filled with all manner of wondrous musical toys and Eurorack modular doodles, which they ship worldwide. I'm sad about the emptiness that's all around me, but Choice Mountain, here I come. And while I'm back in the past, I'll buy the world's stock of QMMGs, stick them in storage for a few years, and then flip them on Reverb. I'm going to be a billionaire. So to purchase a modular synthesizer bit by bit, safe in the knowledge that you can absolutely stop at any time and not ruin your life, visit the newly updated signalsounds.com. That's signalsounds.com. Why We Bleep is also sponsored by thonk.co.uk. Hey, you.
Oh, me?
Yeah, you. We want to build things, tinker?
Who are you calling a tinker, you little tinker?
No, I mean you want to make stuff.
What, like frying pans?
No, I mean like musical things, modules, desktop synths, noise generators.
Well, maybe.
What do these noise generators sound like?
They sound like frying pans with food on. And are they cheaper than buying off the shelf?
Yes.
And do I get the satisfaction of building myself?
Yes.
And is everything included so I don't gotta find pots?
Yes.
They have full kits and partial kits.
And do they got frying pans?
No.
I kinda need a new frying pan.
So, to purchase DIY modules, desktop synths and samplers and frying pans...
No frying pans!
And no frying pans, visit thonk.co.uk. That's thonk.co.uk. You little tinker.
Hi, sausages. Today we present a conversation with the absolutely wonderful Everything Everything. Now, if you're a fan of the band, how do you describe Everything Everything's music? They're a band, and they have lots of guitars on stage. Two guitars and a bass guitar. So they look very bandy. But I think of Everything Everything, in many respects, as very kind of electronic. At least, they really appeal to me as a person who predominantly listens to electronic music. It's hard for me to find bands that I find really interesting to listen to. And Everything Everything are absolutely one of those bands. They are really creative and make interesting, bold, odd choices and make songs that transform on a sixpence and are packed with all manner of interesting twists and turns. They are really good at writing earworms. Now, what you might not know about Everything Everything as you look at them on stage with their two guitars, one bass guitar, is the fact that Alex, certainly from the band, Alex Robertshaw, is a modular head. Oh, yes, he is one of us. He has got a beautiful Schwaemann system and a beautiful Verboss system. which if you watch the video version of this on YouTube, you can see behind me. And he uses Schwaemann stuff to make everything, and Verbos, obviously, as well. But the Schwaemann, especially for processing, he's using modular in a really pointed, like, you know, a good way. And we talk in the this conversation about how that is done, how they start writing music and where modular fits into that whole thing. My interest with this conversation was to try and understand some of their process. How do they do it? Especially given that the band don't all live together, you know, where I went to Alex's house to record this, I had to speak to John remotely because John's in Manchester. How do they play live? And trying to eke out some of the kind of tips and tricks in as much as is possible. Because at the end of the day, to write music like everything, you need to be everything, which we're not. But I'm glad we live in a world that has them in. So I will chat more afterwards. I think it's time to speak to the chaps. This is Why We Bleep with everything. Thanks.
The basics of it is that John and I will write the songs together and then we take it to the other guys and sort of get, you know, feedback on what's good and what's not.
Yeah.
Argue over the songs for a long time until they become the songs that people hear. I'll write something and I'll just send it to John. He'll sing something on it and then send it back and then we'll be like, is that good or not or whatever.
Do you both write, will you both write whole tracks by yourselves?
Sometimes.
Yeah. It's very dependent on what we feel it needs. If one of us writes something and we're like, that's the song, and doesn't feel like it needs anything more, then we'll probably not let anyone add anything to it. If it's like, I think I could tweak this here, or this could do the middle eight, or why don't we change the key? Those kind of things are where the collaborations happen a lot.
The songs sort of are getting written like all the way through up until the last minute. There's, you know, arrangement changes and all sorts of stuff changes all the time. So it's not like we don't sort of finish writing and then record and then, you know, it's not like 1, 2, 3 kind of thing. It's always like, I'll be just about to do something for mix and I'll just think like, you know, this is just shit. Let's just change this round here or do that, you know, or whatever. And sometimes we just do that. We did that with like Software Great Man that was like a 4-bar loop, you know, done on Verbos stuff. And then had to cut that down. I decided last minute, I was like, you know, I'm so bored of hearing the fourth chord. So just cut out the fourth chord to the whole track. So turned it to a 3-chord sequence, you know, and it worked. And we were like, yeah, this is so much more exciting. I'm not hanging around anymore. So stuff like that happens.
Are you like doing, what is that software that you use where you can like listen to someone else's session? Do you do that and just sit and pick stuff?
Audio Movers.
Yeah. Do you use that?
So I use it with the guy I produce with, Tom.
Yeah.
We will do that here. So I'll be like working on something. I'll be like, Tom, this sounds shit. Or, you know, please give me your ears. I've been on it all day. And he'll just like tune in. But we tend to not do that. It's sort of like more problematic than anything, you know, Audio Movers. Yeah. And because people are trying to listen, there's a bit of a delay. And then like, you also have to somehow offer your screen up for them to watch. And I don't like it. I'd rather just someone be in the room. It's much quicker to have someone just with you.
Yeah. So do you both work in the same DAW and like trade sessions?
We just work in Ableton. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have done.
Ableton as well. That feels unusual for like a band, if that makes sense. Like, I just feel like Logic or Pro Tools is just like this sort of default, but.
Yeah. I just, you know, it's like closer to, you know, modular or something. It's like, it's just the routing and the, you know, be able to pull up like a Max for Live LFO and send that to somewhere else in the session or whatever. And
yeah.
You just can't, you know, if you want to do it in Pro Tools, it's like, get out the manual, you know? And, but we do track, like drums and bass, and we'll track all the like live parts. We'll track in Tools because we do it, you know, if we have to go to a studio, not here, then we'll track that in Tools. And then I'll just sort of import it into Ableton. So we do use both.
I suppose that's then the question is, because you are recording in studios, is how much do you feel you get done here
And then at what point you take that to a studio? What is it that you're doing there? Do you write there, or is it just like, now we just got to get better sounding versions?
Well, the studio is more like getting live drums, you know, like I can't do live drums in this room. And then obviously we, you know, record bass at the same time because it's sort of like that's an interaction there between the two players.
Yeah.
And then John's vocals we'll do there because we've got proper booth. And maybe we can get a decent mic, you know, rent a 67 or something.
Yeah. Tell us about your studios as well. Like, John, what is your, what, where do you write and what do you put around yourself when you write?
Well, we have a studio in Stockport where we rehearse, so I do a bit of writing there. I could write here in my house, but I always feel like people can hear me singing and it puts me off a bit. Because obviously I sing in kind of a ridiculous way, and the idea of neighbors hearing me go like 10 in the morning is just sort of makes me cringe. So I go and do that at the studio. But yeah, I usually just do it with a laptop and a guitar, same as Alex, really. But with far less equipment. I'm very much a placeholder, sort of wang a synth in so I can get my song on the go rather than try and get a good sound.
You're not producing like a whole track. You're literally, you're doing more of a trad demo, basically.
Increasingly so, yeah. Partly because I often find if I take it further, then it just sort of gets rolled back anyway. Not all the time. but that happens a lot, you know, and it's the song is actually more important at that stage for both of us than a cool sound or whatever. So the productions, sometimes it can be the thing that excites everybody, but it's kind of not a great sign if that's the first thing, I think, because then it's like, okay, well, we've got a cool sound, but where's the song? So I try to see past it and get a song that feels great with like shit sounds.
Yeah.
And then try and get the sounds a little bit better and then share it and then see what happens song and production-wise after that.
Yeah, that's the sort of like Vince Clarke way of like, he would write, you know, mega synthy music on a guitar, right? And then orchestrate it. But that definitely comes across like, I mean, particularly, John, like, I want to ask you about your vocals, because it's like when I listen to the music, I'm like, I've always thought of everything as a kind of like your vocals, especially, as quite electronic, like in the sense that they have the kind of detail and sort of, they remind me of like stuff from Aphex Twin. They remind me of like, you know, they are complex, interesting, like melodies. Right. It's just really interesting to me how on earth you write them. Like, how do you do that? Because they're such an intrinsic part of the song. You simply can't take them away.
I don't really know. I mean, how do you write anything is a tricky question to answer. I am quite used to the recording process, so maybe I take a few more steps in terms of intricacy because I know it can come across. It'd be hard to do that if you were in, you know, Led Zepp or whatever, because it just isn't that sort of world. But I know this is going to be recorded and it's going to be quite a highly processed vocal by the time it gets to the end of the process, because that's how we like to do it, and that's particularly Tom's forte, is basically comping to a degree that is kind of absurd, and like he really likes it to be perfect, and we have a good relationship in that regard, where it's like, I know I can, my mouth will be able to do this thing, but it's kind of an insane thing to do just in a room with a load of, you know, noise crashing about. It's much more like a studio sound, maybe that's what it is. And when I play live, I have kind of like a studio sound in my ears. It isn't a very live sound. I have my voice ridiculously loud and compressed and stuff so that I can definitely make sure that stuff is happening rather than the more like wild shit that we would do in bands before, I guess.
It's like, yeah, the clarity is something that I noticed. I was like, I can actually hear every word you say, which is sort of, I remarked to myself, as like, is that normal? Like, I often struggle to perceive lyrics in songs, and I don't know if that's just bad hearing. I'm not a vocalist, so this is not a discipline that I have a great deal of understanding of, but I noted it.
Tom and I are quite sticklers for diction and stuff in the studio. We do sort of put that on John quite a lot. He sort of hates it, but...
I always think they make me over-dictate songs and over-enunciate, and then when you listen back, it's fine, but... I do quite like the thing you're talking about, which is where you can't tell what someone's saying, even if it's really well recorded. I don't know. I think my style probably does require that thing. Otherwise, it's just going to sound like a madman understand, you know.
It also, because it's falsetto, does it not sit in a frequency? Does it sit higher? What frequency range does that? I don't know. Like, and therefore, is it easier to mix and easier to perceive, I guess?
John sings falsetto in sort of two ways. He has like a sort of head voice, like, which is the normal way someone do falsetto. And this other way is, you know, the one that John does, which is like full power, which I...
What is that?
I don't understand how he does it.
It's a bit more like a metal scream, but without the sort of grit side.
Yeah.
So it should fit very well over, you know, like low tuned guitars and all that kind of stuff. But then our band doesn't sound anything like that. And we're likely to fill any gaps there are with something anyway. So I don't know. I think it's probably probably the same as any vocal, but it's just maybe a bit higher. But it's not really. It's not actually pitch wise. It wouldn't be higher than a female singer, for example. And I sing low quite a lot as well anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Like you don't exclusively do that, but I really like it. And it's
good.
I think it's because basically the way of putting it, when I say it's like reminds me of electronic music, it's that concept of, you know, brain dance, which is like the Aphex sort of reflex concept of brain dance being the electronic music that will make your brain dance. That is that it,
yeah,
you know, the melodies are so fascinating and detailed that you can just kind of slightly bug out just listening to the following them. It's like following a guitar solo, I guess, but it's your voice, which is much more intricate than I would hear in other music. You know, I don't know other bands that would do that, but I know like electronic music that would be a bit like that. Also, regarding the enunciation, I did notice there was a very well pronounced at the end of like on the record on Mountain Head. There's like it was just on its own, like it was perfect.
Well, that's probably Tom's work.
Yeah, exactly.
Tom has like a little folder of just those.
Like little just, elements, just to,
yeah,
just like drag it in,
like animations.
Yeah.
Obviously, we talked about studios, Alex. We are surrounded by a lot of gear. Obviously, if John is basically predominantly laptop and guitar, what do you work with? What have we got like around us now?
I'm sort of the same, to be honest. If I'm writing a song, I'll just forget most of this stuff exists. If I want to write a song, and then some days I'll come in, I'll be like, I want to play with some synths, and then something will happen. I'll be like, oh, I should record that. And then you think,
pull it out of the bag later.
What harmony will go with that later? And da 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 da. And then suddenly that will turn into a song. So that happens sometimes. You know, John came up and we decided that we were just going to start writing a song, you know, that way. And that led to like Teletype, that song, because we're using the Teletype.
Perfect. And see what you did there.
Very simple, very basic. So that will happen. But in general, if I spend too much time just sort of fiddling, you never press record, you just sort of...
Yeah.
The world of modular does that to you.
It's antithetical to, like, creativity in some respects. So at least, sorry, I should say more specifically, it's like the complexity of this is just a nightmare if you actually have an idea of what you want.
Well, it's just the case of like, oh, this sounds great, but what happens if I do this? Yeah. Oh, that also sounds great, what happens if I do this? And then all of a sudden it's like an hour's gone.
No music is written.
Nothing's actually been recorded. And you're like, so it's better. I find it better to just sort of have a track and then start to try and incorporate, you know, some of the stuff, you know, or process stuff. Mainly I use like all the Schramm stuff just for processing, you know, all the guitars just went through that straight onto the track. I did all DI mainly this record. And
why Schwayman? And what are you doing to the guitars?
I like the pre's, and I'd have three, you know, I run it in three lines. So I'll just have it going through the stereo filter, and then I'll have one that's going to the chorus, the Juno chorus. And every time I record a track, I have a bunch of effects that will sit the guitar at a certain point in the field.
Yeah.
And so as we're going through the song, I'll decide, okay, do I want the guitar to be up front? Do I want it to be here? Da, da, da. And I don't have to dick about later, like sending it in and out of processing. Okay. It just all goes in one.
So you're using filters to sort of move stuff, put it
move stuff around, and I'll take you know, LFOs or whatever, you know, out the expert sleepers, and that will modulate to the, you know, things will be modulating always to the track, and I just like hard set them. I start a record off every time, and I'm like, what am I going to use? And I go, this one, this one, this one, this one, and then I like just literally wire it up, and I just think, okay, that's the guitar sound this record, and then that'll be that, and then just pick and choose afterwards.
Did you mention like the you were using the MMF2 for like stereo, for like for binaural, like you were creating binaural sounds with basically a quad filter. Is it a quad?
It's a stereo filter, but when you choose like two poles and you send one signal in, and then you've got like, you know, opposing 180 degree phase LFOs, whatever, you can create this kind of like whizzing around your head kind of stuff. Streaming stuff just sounds like
it's like the Rolls Royce of synthy.
It just sounds really, really nice, and it sits up in a mix really nicely. Like verbal stuff, I love it, but I find with like a full band and stuff, it just disappears. But somehow Schramm's just like right there, always on top of everything.
Really, I did hear this thing. Like sort of like how much of it is modular? Like, do you know what I mean? Like I'm hearing bits that sound like they would be verbosy, sort of Buchlery bongo tones.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's all verbos stuff, like the Buchlery type stuff.
Yeah. I guess like you just don't see it like as a band, like if you know, and I've seen you play as well, and that's what I mean when it's not obvious how much of it is electronic and how much of it is processed. It's very hard to tell, obviously.
It's very hard to tour with this stuff.
Yeah, just a bit.
So we don't, you know, I don't do it. And I don't really want to tour. I toured a bit with it when we were doing I Want to Love Like This. I took like a small setup and it was cool, but it's like, I don't know, stuff just gets broken on the road and it just makes me nervous.
Yeah, totally. Like if you're selling out a like big show, you just can't afford to have weird.
But you could just go, okay, cool. Well, let's make a cheaper dopefer version or whatever. And then you're like, actually, it's worked out far more expensive because I need like 20 times the amount of stuff to make that possible. There's just no kind of shortcut way. Luckily, we have Pete in the band who kind of like, I'll explain what's happening and he'll sort of make that happen within Ableton somehow, like routing things around.
And so when you play live, like how much of it is, do you have like a backing track or do you commit that it is all played?
Pete's the backing track.
Pete the backing track.
Pete is like the human backing track.
What does how does it work?
He has Ableton, but he has sample pads doing loads of the stuff. And then he's got two keyboards here, another one here, and they're all kind of like split in half doing different sounds.
Oh my God.
He's just absolutely mad. Like, Pete, you know, some of it can actually just go on backtrack. No one can see that you're doing all of this. He's like, no.
Yeah, he insists on it.
He's like, it must be played.
I respect that.
It must be played.
I respect. Yeah, I mean, and it's a question. Like, I've done that. Like, I've literally been the guy who's like, well, you've written loads of electronic bits and I've had to like stand on stage and trigger and fire them. And then because the band that I played with had a pathological hatred of a laptop being on stage, they were like, it is verboten. Like, can't be done, you know. But then I don't know. Does it matter?
Well, it's just, you know, you can't do seven albums and just have like
somehow
a couple of synths that you for every single
just
record.
Somehow, like, do that.
Yeah, when we were like any band, you like to explore different sounds and stuff. And the only way to be able to play all those different sounds, all different records, is to have some sort of like, you know, laptop setup.
What are your like? I suppose then the question is like, what do you want from a live show? Like, what are your? Do you have like best favorite live shows you've seen and what and why?
I like shows where you feel like it's going to fall apart at any second and the band pulls it back. So when you see like Nick Cave or something, it's like it's got a real kind of like you feel tense the whole time because it's so chaotic.
I've never seen Nick Cave. Well, I mean, why? What's he do?
It's just when the whole band's playing and it's like it just. Yeah, you got to see it. You got to see, see it. They're one of those bands where you think like, is the song gonna end or are they found? When's the chorus gonna happen? And yeah, this is kind of like, it's a bit chaotic. So I've seen bands that like that.
Yeah,
and our music is most of the time not like that. So, you know, for me in our band, I like to be able to sort of bring a bit of that in somehow, in terms of, you know, having real instruments that are kind of like a bit uncontrollable.
Yeah. What about you, John? What's your...
I like that too, when it's not controlled. You get a bit, it can get a bit sterile sometimes, listening to a click and all that shit. But then there's times when I'm like so thankful that I've got the time and the pitch in my ear and I can't hear anything else, you know. That's kind of unbeatable safety net. But maybe it affects the emotion portion in some way that I can't perceive because I'm feeling too safe. Maybe I should feel a bit more on edge.
Do you play to a click track then? You have a
oh yeah
yeah
Yeah, we had to do that.
There's two songs in our arsenal that don't have a click track.
Yeah, if the backing track goes down, you know, as in Pete's world just kind of like explodes, we have two songs which we don't even know how to play anymore. I think it's like My Keys,
Suffragette,
My Keys.
Maybe Photoshop. Click as well.
Basically, stuff from album one.
Really? Why? Yeah. Why?
Because everything after that went on click, and
you got organized.
Because I was still playing keys back then,
right?
Yeah,
and John
was on keys.
It was all extremely chaotic, and then we got Pete in, and started putting some things on track. And at that point, obviously, you have to have a click.
I was going to ask about like the very concept of albums as well. Obviously, like as in concept albums, because it sounds like, you know, they sent me the whole like the text about this album and the idea behind it. I mean, we were talking about Daniel Ek before in this whole thing, you know, with Spotify, and maybe I'm being cynical and I don't really know the answer to this, but I get the impression that people don't, you know, cynically, I would say people don't listen to albums, but I don't know if that's true. I know people do put stuff off, you know, put stuff on when they work, but when do people sit down and actually, you know, turn the lights off and listen to an album? And that it would be interesting to get your thoughts both on the idea behind albums and why do you come up with the idea, the concept, the story first, and does that then inform the writing or does it just emerge organically? And just albums in general, and I obviously love it, but I just don't know if a lot of other people spend time listening to music in that way.
I don't think anyone does really, yeah. Not in the same way as they used to. It's not the 90s anymore. It has changed quite a lot. I mean, in terms of the idea, the sort of lyrical ideas, that comes along quite late, doesn't it, John? Usually it kind of appears as you go along.
Yeah. I might be considering a few different things and then I'll write something that I think fits into this. And then I might think, well, I'm going to fit something else into it and go from there. But I don't think it's particularly interesting to have a really strict concept and have every song must align with this thing. It's nice to keep it quite vague and just, it's more like a palette that you can draw from. If it's an interesting enough idea, then it will make people think about it, you know, when they're not listening to the record, and it'll color all the tracks a little bit, even if realistically they don't have anything to do with it. But it gives it the whole sense of the record is more than just here's a bunch of songs. It's got this added stuff to think about, which I think is interesting. It's like a novel, and rather than just every chapter is a short story. It's a novel, and there's a bigger thing to it. A very vague novel.
But it's interesting, and it's, you know, there is like this imagery basically that is conjured up by the story that is attached to this mm-hmm. album. And I was listening to the lyrics looking for. Does it actually have it in like the liner notes? How do you tell people nope. about it? It doesn't.
It goes out in a press release, and we sort of allude to it a lot in interviews and in the promotional stuff, but we don't write it on the record or anything. That's quite a bit too prog. And also very few people will have a physical thing in their hand.
Yeah.
So you just sort of let it, basically you put out fragments of it or you explain it in the song, which is what we've done this time, which is the most obvious way. And then you let people talk amongst themselves. And we have the kind of fan base that really likes theorizing and discussing stuff, so you kind of throw them some red meat and see where they take it in the gap between the first single and the record itself, and they'll create quite a lot of interesting lore and backstory and stuff attached before the record even comes out, and then there's loads more in there for them to add on to.
Are you thinking about it when you write, I suppose, is the question. Is it inspiring the melodies? Is it inspiring the instrumentals?
No.
Is it just the lyrics and the kind of...
It's just the lyrics and the way it looks sometimes. I mean, there's one place where we've got the sounds of like drips in a cave at the start of one of the songs, which I guess you could say is the sound of the concept, but that's the only place it comes into it. And even then, they don't even sound like drips and they're never explained.
There's a baby laughing at the end of the album as well.
That's Alex's baby.
I put my kid in my tracks as well. It's nice. When I write music, I don't because I write electronic music, it's so often led by the equipment and the sound or like a melody that you come across. And I've never actually, and this is probably bad of me, and if I'd ever like studied music, then I'd be told to do this. But like, you know, if you actually create an image or a story, it does spark ideas. It does give you a thing. It has to have some kind of...
It definitely does, but we put the music... The music has to be good without it, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
The music's always sort of first, basically.
The song should be good enough without any vocal in.
Yeah.
You know, the drum track should be good enough to listen to by itself. Everything that comes on top of it is a bonus once the song's good, like the lyric and the concept and all that stuff. That's the side that people tend to focus on more because it's difficult to just say you've written some more songs that sound like good songs. It's much easier to say, you've got this concept, tell me about the concept. And then that sometimes becomes the focus when the focus is the songs and the music, and we're a band that plays songs and music. It's quite a weird situation to be in because it's difficult to to talk about.
It's like the last record, it was like everyone wants to talk about is like the AI angle and all this kind of stuff. And we're just like, yeah, the song's also there as well. underneath it, there's some music, you know.
No one would care if the song sucked, you know.
Yeah.
Like press will fixate on the things that they can conceive of and understand. But yeah, like, do you write all the time? And you said you're in a bit of a musical lull at the moment.
As soon as I finish a record, I use that time to literally completely power down from music for about a month or two. Mainly because I'm completely burnt out.
Yeah.
I find, you know, writing with John and then doing the production side of it, like, pretty knackering by the end of it. Especially this time around, because we had like this crazy deadline, an obscene amount of work in a short amount of time. And you just, yeah.
Do you mean you started late or you just got an arbitrary deadline?
They were like, you know, it'd be good if you had an album out like this time. We were like looking at our folders of songs that we'd written. We're like, haven't got any. And then it's like, okay, better go start writing. And it was, and we got it done in time, you know, but it was just so full on. And when that sort of comes to an end, it's like a massive crash.
Yeah.
Especially with like, you got young kids as well. So like you're working crazy hours and then, you know, doing all the rest of it, you know, which you would know.
If you're like a father during the daytime and then somehow trying to find time to do that, I don't.
Yeah, that's why I work here, like in my house, because it's literally like, you know, sometimes I was setting alarms and getting up at like, I was like, well, the kids usually wake up around 7 or come down at 4:30, you know, and just like start finishing that bit of whatever it is, like comp, put my headphones on or whatever. It's just like, oh my God, what am I doing? But once it's over, I like a break, mainly because I just feel a bit like if I was to force writing, I'd find myself finding it like not enjoyable.
Like a job.
You resent it.
So it's best to just have a break, go off, wait for the music to sort of come back to you. I just go off and I'll do other things. And then one day I'll be listening to the radio. I'll be like, oh, that's quite a good song. You know, and suddenly it's like the interest just suddenly reappears and enters your brain. And then you're like, that drive comes back and you just want to go right.
On one level, people would say creativity isn't something you can just like force, but there is also that side that they say, you know, good artists or good, you know, musicians, writers will just sit down and do the work, like just sit down.
Yeah. I mean, there are times where you're like, okay, I've got to write and I don't know, I'm a bit short on ideas or whatever. And you just go, okay, well, I'm just going to get in the room and just do it. And that often works. Sometimes I find, like going back to what we were talking about, you know, using gear or not using gear, I'll find, you know, well, right now I'm going to focus on one piece of gear and really learn it, like Teletype or, you know, Pulsar or whatever. And I'll just sit down with it and I'll go, okay, this is all I'm going to do today because I sort of hate myself and my life. And I don't want to write any songs. And all of a sudden you'll get to the end of the day and you'll just have like one of the best songs you've ever. And then that excites you. And the next day you come back and you'll be like, listen back again. You're like, okay, cool. Well, now I need these chord sequences, maybe that could be better. Da, da, da. And suddenly you kind of like, you springboard off again, you know. But in general, once the record's finished, I like to have a little break.
What about you, John? How do you feel about the whole process?
Yeah, same. I don't, I don't like music very much at the end of an album cycle, or, you know, an album creation cycle. And then it slowly gain interest back. It's usually a very similar thing where you'll hear something, you'll kind of go, oh yeah, I see what they've done there. I could probably do some. I could probably either do that or do better than that. And it's that feeling of like, I want to take that feeling that it just gave me and give it to other people, basically. Not in terms of like literally copying stuff, but it's more like something that we've not tried and then someone's done it. And it can be a song, you know, it could be an Elton John song from the 70s. And I go, well, the way he changed key going into that chorus is so great. I wonder what he's done there. And you go and look into it and sort of beat around the same bush until you get the same feeling.
What is your relationship to the tools as well, John? With like the, you know, if you're a vocalist and guitarist, are you looking at synth plugins or like other things to find sounds to inspire you? Or is it always, do the sounds inspire you? Or is it other songs, melodies and things you
hear? No, they do. Sounds do. I feel like I've got more sounds available to me now than I could ever use. And I know I have a fraction of what Alex has got at his disposal. But it feels like sometimes it's just enough to get the idea over to the other guys in the band. It's like I'll use a choir patch or something. Doesn't matter if it's not the best one in the world, but it's like you get the idea. This is going to be a choir type sound, or these are strings. It's the same old strings I always use. But I do like it when I find a new thing. I'm not searching for that all the time.
And presumably, you need to get it fast. Like I assume because if As with all of this, it's what I say about the modular. It's just like, whatever you use, you just need to, it needs to work really quickly if you have an idea.
Yeah, that's the thing. You can cycle through, you know, 8,000 sounds on just the soft synths I've got in Ableton. Like, one of those is going to work for this idea that I've got in my head, or it will for the next 24 hours or whatever.
I get the impression listening through the albums that electronics have become more of a part of the sound. Like, it's never just guitars, it's never just synths. It's but do you see yourself doing something weirder in future? Would you, I mean, I don't want to say what I'm going to say, would you do a Kid A? Are you going to Kid A at some point? And just be like, fuck it.
I think we already did on Man Alive. Like, there was electronic stuff on our first record.
Yeah, I don't know if we'll do a whole record of it. I don't know.
But it's like you've got an appetite for guitars, I guess is the point, or at least the sound or the way that you, the melodies you get from it.
I don't like guitar at all, really. I enjoy playing in the band and I like doing things with guitars that you shouldn't be doing with guitars. But then, you know, when you're like looking through Instagram or whatever and you'll see some guitarists just like playing some...
Widdly.
Yeah.
Widdly way.
And you just think like, is this what guitarists like? And I just don't like that, you know. I prefer like, you know, we're all Radiohead fans. Everyone likes Johnny Greenwood or Sonic Youth. Someone who uses a guitar and makes it do something that's unexpected is exciting for me. And I don't know, I feel a bit like a lot of that's been done. And I really like the sound of synths. And then I usually play, you know, like I'll split the chord up over a few things and then one of the notes will be the guitar and I'll just bed that in. And so a lot of time people hear the record, they're like, oh, there's no guitars in this record. It's like, it's absolutely shitloads, but you can't tell they're there, or you can't tell what's a guitar and what's a synth because it's all being processed in similar ways, or, you know, swapping roles kind of thing.
I did talk to someone once who was doing a Bach album on a Moog modular, but was hybridizing it with the orchestra and doing exactly that, where you just like roles switch interchangeably. And I suppose it's the idea that, like, on some level, all music now is electronic, no matter how acoustic it sounds, because it's gone through a computer and it's probably been processed and it's probably got like an 808 sub under it. You know, I've heard that, like, you know, Ed Sheeran live album, when it was mixed, an 808 was put underneath it, you know, and it's just him on a looping pedal. But it's
chef's kiss.
Not him on a looping pedal in an 808. But everything is, to some degree, is electronic, because you just like, well, I'm just going to add to it. I'm going to make it sound better. But
yeah, there is an argument for overcooking, and we do that quite a lot as a band.
How do you know when you've gone too far, though? And how do you pull yourself back from that break?
We call it doing a fucko.
What's a fuck up? Well, I mean, it's what when, it sounds like.
Most of the time, Alex has been sat at a laptop for like 4 or 5 hours, and the thing that we left him doing has long since departed, and it's turned into like something completely insane that probably sounded great to him 3 hours ago, and then 2 hours later it was different, and then an hour ago from now he won't recognize the original, and it's like it probably does sound amazing if you've been on his journey, and we're just going like, what is this? He's fuckoed it, or it's a fucko is the phrase. That's when you know you've gone too far. And to be honest, in an alternative universe, all the fuckos are on our albums, and they're probably great, but sometimes it goes too far and you lose the band and you lose, you know, where we came from, stuff like that.
Yeah.
What the fuck does sound like? I want to hear one. Like, you know, like what can you describe one to me, like a good example?
This wasn't one I did, but this is a great moment when we were doing Get to Heaven. One of the tracks that wasn't on the main record, Habsburg Lip. We were working with Stuart Price. Tom and I were recording everything in here in England, and then we were sending it to him in LA, and then overnight he'd sort of like put his magic fairy dust on things. And one day he sent back Habsburg Lip, and if you know the original track, it's like it's quite a heavy sort of electronic thing. And he just sent back just like straight up like Peter Andre sort of reggae version.
Wow.
Hit me baby with your Habsburg Lip. And we were just like, what is this? And John was absolutely fuming at it at the time.
Yeah.
And then funny thing was that it went straight in the bin at Angelic in the studio and on the computer. And then about 4 years later, Tom and I were there recording another band. And they never delete anything. So I was like, go in the bin. And see if it was still there. I listened to it and I just thought, this is so good. Right then, and I was like, we should have done this. This would have been awesome. So, yeah. Things sound differently at different times of your career.
That's cool, being like ahead of the curve, isn't it? Fuck, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That then leads to the question, which is, I got an email the other day. I got I'm subscribed to like, you know, Medium things. You get like interesting like dissertations and thoughts. And there was a guy who was talking about the Beatles, and he was saying what was so good about the Beatles is that, especially latterly, obviously, is that their music was very weird, and you'd get really unexpected changes. And the way that he put it, I thought was really good, is he's like, but they always made it feel inevitable. And it's that idea that you can have really odd changes in a song that are not traditional, whatever that is. And I do think like your band has some of that. There are changes and shifts in the songs that are perhaps unexpected, because the songs are very they're just interesting. They're much freer and opener than a lot of the music I've heard on the radio. And I suppose then that's the question, is how do you, and this is sort of, I guess it's probably like a slightly anti-fucko, is how do you write a whole song from start to finish that has that sense of inevitability, even though it can do really weird things? How do you keep it sounding like, oh no, that is, how could it be any other way?
Well,
and I know that's like hindsight when I listen back.
Well,
to
there's
it.
Like a bunch of times where we'll have two songs and both songs just weren't up to scratch, but there may be like a good bit from each song.
Right.
And then, you know, we'll literally just go dunk. You know, within Ableton, put two songs or parts of songs together. And then
it's a case of jacking the keys around until they feel either inevitable, as you say, or surprising in a way that we didn't predict.
Mm.
And that's the same with the time, how fast these songs have got like a 20 BPM difference. If we put this one up 10 and that one down 10, are they both ruined? Does this one suddenly get better? Does this one get worse? And those little things make weird stuff happen, those little decisions.
Yeah. And then you spend a lot of time, you know, I'll spend quite a long time just working on like just transition, you know, how would you transition from one section to the next to make it feel natural?
Those are the things. What are your tricks?
Well, I'll loop. If, you know, like when you're working on a track, you often find yourself like, you know, doing a looping a section, but I'll loop over the bar lines. I'll loop halfway through the chorus into halfway through the verse.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'll just like be going round and round, just thinking like, how can I improve that? Or I'll think about guitar parts, like, you know, note choices that I can overhang, or like if I hit this particular note, then I'll be in, you know, I'll be in a slightly weird note for the next chord or key, but it will still work in a way that's kind of like suggesting a cadence or something. Cadence is over the bar line and stuff like that.
I never thought about like looping, putting a loop brace over the join, you know.
Over the join and work out just like what's going over, what's still overhanging, what shouldn't be there. What, you know, do you want it to be a hard, do you want like an edge? Sometimes you want like an edge on a song where you want it to be like, bam.
Yeah.
And sometimes you want to feel like you're naturally being taken somewhere deeper and then the bang comes later, like at the chorus or whatever.
Yeah. Tell me, like you were alluding to like, it's Tom that you, is like the other producer, you have like a producing sort of duo.
He's like, Tom's like from a engineering background. So right. He engineered with us on, from the second album. Yeah, I grew up with him. I've known him since I was like five, so.
Oh, that's good.
So we're just like really close friends.
Yeah.
And we can both sort of tell each other we're being terrible or whatever, you know.
And it's okay.
And it's fine, basically, yeah. And we know what we do well and what we don't, so.
What does, I suppose there's like two questions. One is I'd be interested to know more about what he does and like how it works. And also just like the role of producers in general, because you obviously work with like James Ford and other people and like, you know, it. I don't know what that means really. Like, what does it mean to work with a producer and to, for them to have some influence over your music, and what are the positives and the negatives of it, and how does it, what have you learned from it?
I mean, working with James Ford was interesting because he said to us, you know, when someone asked him, you know, what does it mean to be a producer? And he just says, oh, I help people finish their music.
Yeah.
And like, in whatever way that is. So does he need to help write the song a little bit? Does he need to play on it? Does he need to do this? Does he need to do that? I think that's probably the best way of describing the role of producer. And also there's the kind of like, you know, sometimes the whole band is like arguing over something. And then I'll have to put my producer cap on, but I don't, I feel less guilty because I've got Tom. And Tom can step in and go, you know, right, you really should do this. Well, Alex is saying you should do this kind of thing. And then it's like, not so bad then, you know. So it's important to have someone there who's basically got the final say sometimes. Okay. But mainly it's just someone who will help you finish what you're doing in whatever way it is, or someone that just sees it as a place for it to, you know, somewhere, you know, final destination or
whatever. Yeah. Do you remember any of the like lessons, the sort of songwriting lessons? I've read some of that. I haven't read it all, but like the Rick Rubin book, which is quite interesting. I don't know if you read that.
I haven't read it.
It's very spiritual, but it's good. It's like, you know, it's interesting.
I don't recognize this at all, was the story we heard about him turning up to, he was turning to London and had a team over there that were mixing a track, and he came in, sat down, and the song was playing. He went, I don't recognize this at all. And then he put on AC/DC and then he left. And that's the story I know about Rick Rubin. Oh,
wow. So James Ford never did that to you?
No, that's probably good. No, James Ford's he's very fast. So him and Stuart are very similar in that way. Very, very fast, very quick workers. David Coston, you feel like nothing's happening but loads is. He's sort of very quiet and in the background. Sometimes you'll turn around and you're like, what's David up to? And he'll just be in the corner, like on the move, just pressing one key really slowly, like... You're like, what are you doing, David? Oh, sorry. he's that producer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then who else have we worked with?
John
Congleton, yeah.
Congleton.
He works extremely fast, like crazy fast.
And when you say they work fast, what do you mean? They just like just
like
get more done, just get it
do,
done.
Do one take and then you say, right, now I'll do a good one. And they're like, no, you're done.
Yep. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, that's Congleton.
Yeah.
And James Ford's just fast on the computer, like, he's like whipping his way around Pro Tools like it's Ableton, like it'll just be like making huge arrangement changes, and it's just crazy how fast he is in that. Anyway, I mean, that's more like technical skill, but as actual people, they're all like really interesting people.
Yeah.
Like David Coston's like a fascinating man, and so, you know, they're all really, and they all sort of impart like years of knowledge that you don't have.
But how does it work if you're producing the album? You know, if you and Tom are producing, do you... Is it the same? But how can you be in the band and produce the band, I suppose, is what I mean.
With great difficulty.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, not really. Not really.
No, it's been fine, actually. Okay. I think it's always been a little bit of, that's been the case, you know, working up demos like very far. I've always done that even before they've gone to, we had another producer come on board. It'd be like, they'd be sonically very, very, you know, sure of themselves. The songs will know their identity sonically. And also the writing, you know, always like to be like massively prepared before we start having to, you know, pay someone a lot of money in the studio to do it. We work the songs up really far, and then when you go into the studio, they often find a new. It's usually down to the drums. So you'll go into the studio and you suddenly realise that, you know, obviously electronic drums and real drums have a totally different sound.
Yeah.
And you'll think, well, okay, well, how can we use these live drums in a way that's either going to fit in with the demo or, you know what, we're here, let's do something a bit more interesting. And then sometimes I'll like throw the whole track sonically and then I'll have to like come back and rework it all back up.
To match the like impressiveness of live drums.
Yeah, or just like the tone of the track could be like the synths need to be sort of.
It's
like
usually the unimpressiveness actually of the live drums.
Oh no,
because electronic drums are incredibly powerful and they're perfect every time, and you can have six kick drums or whatever. I know that's not allowed, but you can do a lot of things that a drummer can't do, and it's going to sound incredible. Or a sample, you know, of something that has sounded great for 50 years. And then you get in there and you play it on real drums and it quite often sounds kind of quite white, I always find. Like it sounds like a function band. If you've got like a really funky beat that sounds cool when it's electronic and then you play it on drums, it sort of starts sounding a bit lame and you have to come up with all these ways to like de-lamify it. And quite often that we'll find that we will have one element we'll keep electronic. So we'll have a hi-hat, which is a drum machine. That's getting processed and stuff, but then the rest of the drums are being played by Mike and they're more organic sounding. And that's a really good way of mixing it up so no one's sure quite what's going on. And we haven't just chucked the drummer out and replaced him.
Poor Mike.
Sometimes you basically want to do as little as you want to the drums, you know, little, like as in the timing should just be Michael.
Yeah.
And the songs are going to be a bit hairier and that's kind of cool. And then sometimes when you want it to be more electronic, I'll do things like like for this last record, I was using the swing on the Circlon and then just like, you know, sending in like a trigger into Ableton. And I was literally like going through his drums and lining them up with the swing of the Circlon to get it in time with the original thing or whatever. And so sometimes you go like that route and the other times you go the other route.
I was listening to bits of that album and I was like, I cannot tell if that is a drum machine or if that's real drums. It was like... And maybe it's the sound of real drums that have been like amazingly brought into, well, Circlon obviously has like insanely good timing, but with an electronic swing. I think of the drum sounds in like the Nigel Godrichy drum sound is like, I definitely hear some of that like dry, it's a really nice dry drums that he seems to create. And I do hear it on your records too.
Yeah.
Like that kind of.
Well, they're really good because you can have, when you've got small, tight drums, you can then have quite a lot of stuff around them. If you have like big, hairy, ballsy drums, it's quite hard to then go, okay, well, we want bass guitar, strings, synths, voices. So a lot of that is down to like, you know, how big is this song going to be? And then you think, okay, well, if the song's going to be really big, with lots of elements, then I need the drums to sound sort of smaller and tighter.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we talked about the Joshua Tree a few albums ago. It tends to come up. And Alex was always saying the drums actually sound really small and therefore the drums, the songs, the U2 songs sound really big as a result, which goes against what you might think. You'd imagine, let's put some big drums on like Nirvana.
Yeah.
It doesn't always have the effect you'd expect.
You have the opposite effect. You use more, you know, you can get a really like ballsy, roomy drum sound, but then you have to put those drums quieter. And then the energy that comes from the air moving, which you get through like the room mics and stuff, make them sound really energetic and pounding, even at a quieter volume, which is what I've, you know, Joshua Tree sounds a bit like that to me personally.
It's that idea that when you mix things, it's bad to EQ things in isolation, right? It's just that all of the frequencies of everything, all the other parts are going to combine. I'm sure, like, you know, bass guitar and drums obviously need to work together, and some of what people will perceive as the energy of the drums will come from the bass.
Which
you can only hear if there's room for it to exist, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Alex, I wanted to ask you about these things a bit, like particularly things like teletype as well. These are very like esoteric, unfriendly, odd ways of approaching music creation. And I suppose it's more just like your thoughts about the effect of like, what do you enjoy about them?
Teletype's the only thing I have now that's like intensely kind of like deep, as it were.
You said like you were saying like, that's it. That and your quasar are like the only the things quasar, that have any kind of screen.
Any type of screen, and you have to sort of menu dive a bit because my brain's not really good. I just forget how to use everything. But with the Teletype, I do love the Teletype, but I use it. I'm a very basic user. I like it to power off the Verbos sequences because you can sort of just like put a little bit of code in that will do, you know, Euclidean rhythm, and you're away. And it's a bit wonky. Like every time I press play, it will do something slightly different. And sometimes you're like, bam, you're like, oh my God, this is great. Like the way it's decided to fall on the bar with the whatever, you know. And I kind of find the happy accident side of it, like what is quite exciting.
Mm.
And I know there's like people, you know, you see people on Instagram using like Teletypes and then you're like absolutely mad.
Yeah, my God.
Like one guy's got it like controlling the lights in his room. Like, so it's like, what the hell's going on? You know,
how do you have time to do it? Do you have kids? Yeah. Like,
yeah. I've got no background in programming. The reason I got it, I was like, you know what? I'd really like to be able to do a bit of programming because I've never done it before. And I know it's not like a particular language that anyone...
It's been made up for that.
Yeah, exactly, or something like that. But I was like, you know, it'd be quite a fun thing to sort of just wrap my brain around on an evening.
Mm.
And suddenly it just started to like leak into, you know, it's just become like a little bit of a brain.
Mm. I had this like, a few people I spoke to on this podcast who talked about like doing things they weren't very good at over and over until something good came from it. It sort of almost sounds like you're describing that in some degree. It's like... making things really hard. Like, for example, if you don't play the piano, just like, I'm going to play the piano incredibly badly.
Well, I find that's the best way to write, you know, to write sort of pop songs. You will find yourself writing like simpler things when you're wrestling with something you don't understand. You know, you're sort of like trying to work out how it works, and then your ears will hear something that you're creating and go, you know what, that could be a song. Yeah. And it's very simple. You know, you create something extremely simple. And that's what's sort of magic about it, you know. Whilst if I was to pick up guitar, which I played like all my life, and I was like, I'm going to play the most complex thing possible, I could easily do that. And I could run through, you know, a bunch of keys and blah, 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 blah. But it's like, no one wants to listen to that.
That's widdly way, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Which is why I'm sort of like...
Well, that's jazz.
Yeah, man.
I like feeling like a bit of a novice and a learner. And, I find that more exciting for me in making music that
way. It like will box you in some way.
Yeah.
What about you, John? Do you have like ways of getting out of your normal habits and patterns?
Yeah, I sometimes try to write songs without an instrument at all. So just singing things into my phone in the sort of Michael Jackson way, or just singing to a click and trying to basically hold the whole imagined arrangement in my head while I sing what I think the vocal would be.
Yeah.
Because there's absolutely no skill required in terms of, it's not going to take me half an hour to program in these notes. They're just already there because I'm imagining them. And then try and build a track around that. And that does work and it does make interesting stuff happen, but it usually makes me write songs that sound very like me, if you know what I mean. They sound like songs I've written before, or they're too simple to be engaging enough, I often find. Which actually, if you listen to like all of Michael Jackson's albums in a row, you start to hear a lot of very similar things going on in terms of what he's done. And I think that's because he's written a lot of these songs just by doing that.
Has he?
Yeah. You get this particular thing that he does at the end of every middle eight in an incredible number of songs, or some variation on that. And it'll always, nearly all of them have got these two chord verses. But anyway, that's him.
It's interesting.
There's like a default way your brain's going to go when it comes to creation. And it's trying to shake that up is the trick.
I suppose that's why if you've got something that you're singing against that's weird or different, then it's suddenly going to be like, oh, well, okay, what goes with
which
that?
Which is why it's great that when Alex sends me something that I would never have written, and sometimes I don't even musically agree with, you know, I'm like, why would a chord do that? Or like, why would you repeat that? It throws me off, you know, it throws me into a new way of being, which is good.
Yeah. Tell me about TV Dog.
Yeah.
Because that's just that. And I was struck by that. I was like, this is really nice. Obviously, it's a really good track, but it's also just really simple. And it's just you. And like, there's something that starts and then there's another thing that joins.
And that, some strings and your voice.
Yeah. And that's it.
I was interested in a lot of the record. We were talking about sort of New York, you know, based or originating from New York sort of strings, sort of music. And I was thinking a lot about that Lou Reed track, the dun 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 dun. What is it? Street Hassle? Is it called Street Hassle? Something like that. I can't remember. But that particular song has got this kind of like very simple strings thing. And I started writing TV Dog, whatever it was called at the time. And then I sent it to John, and then John changed the strings up a little bit.
Coney Island.
Coney Island, yeah, you see. Coney Island strings. And then John just sort of worked one of the sections up, and then we just sang on it, and it was literally done in like a day or two. And then I went down to the Abbey down the road and took a, you know, Zoom recorder and just recorded ambience.
Oh.
And then just put that in the track.
Oh.
And then that's it.
Oh, nice. Yeah. That's, I've heard for people who like when they record tracks, they'll hang a mic out the window as they're doing it. So there's like, you know, you get the world baked.
We had the option early on to, in fact, I think I wrote probably two more verses or three more verses because they're quite short. And we cut it back down. We had the option of opening it out, bringing in drums, making it into a big song and all this stuff. And every time we did it, we just liked it less. And we just thought it'll be like a sweet, short, sharp shock type song. Well, not shock, but, you know, just like a nice, here's the melody presented twice.
Yeah.
Why complicate it?
We don't like the feeling as a band of hanging around. That's like one of the biggest dislikes is music that you feel a bit like.
Jog on, mate.
Yeah. Well, it gets too indulgent, you know. And I feel like we've been guilty of that in the past a little bit. Where you think like, you have to think to yourself like, you know, I'm a little bit bored of this by this point. And someone else who doesn't like the band is going to be very, very bored of it if they're subjected to this. And we don't like much of that sort of mood on a record either. We turned our back on sort of like having too many tracks that are like, you know, low energy, we would say, even though it's got a lot of emotion in it, but it's not like rhythmically high energy. We always like to just think, okay, we'll have one or two of those max on a record. And that's kind of our rule.
Of the like the sadder sort, the sadder, slower, not the big like anthemic kind of things.
Yeah. We just have to have one or two just because otherwise it's like, you know. Also, they feel very easy to, for us, they feel quite easy to write those sorts of songs because they come across quite quickly. And because they're quite quick to write, we instantly kind of think they're not very good because we haven't had to work that hard on them or hasn't like pushed us in a way that's sort of like made us feel uncomfortable, which is what we generally like to be made to make each other feel uncomfortable musically.
Musically, okay, yeah. That's fine. It also sounds like it's the benefit of having a band is just this sort of, you've got at least a few people who can just be a filter to like stop, start, go, don't.
Yeah. Sometimes I have to say stop. And sometimes the band says stop to me. It just works both ways. It's fine. It's sort of, once you get to sort of album six or seven, it's like we are very blunt with each other and no one really gets that offended. It's a different sort of relationship by then. You know, often if you're working with a new writer, they've got a lot of, you know, they're sharing themselves in a way that they've probably not done before. And so to have someone say, you know, this isn't very good or this should be swapped for something else or you will, they'll hit back or they'll insulate or whatever. Mm. But we're used to just sort of doing that with each other now. A lot of the reason why we can work so quickly is that we can navigate the songs quite quickly in that sense. We can say, you know, this bit's good. This bit's okay, but I wish it was doing this or da da da. You know, this bit's cool, but the song doesn't need that to happen at that point because we've just had this happen and maybe it should go down here and then da da da, you know, whatever. So there's a lot of sort of pressing the sort of detonation button on something that may have taken one of us like 3 days to make, you know, and it can just happen and then all of a sudden the song gets better. And that bit that we threw away will end up in another song like 2 years later or whatever. So it's not the end of the world.
Or like 9 years later when you find it in the bin, you're like, oh, actually, we should do a reggae album. What is next? Like, do you think of like, are you the kind of band where it's like, well, we've done that, you know, we've got to do this, or we've got to try something? If you say you want to make yourself uncomfortable.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's next.
Probably too early. You're obviously about to play this live a lot. And
And you were saying you're doing a Kit A record. I'm kind of like, in my mind, I was thinking of going the other way.
Mm. Yeah.
And it being like well, everything must be like an organic instrument.
Yeah.
And
I think we say this every time we make an album.
Yeah, we do.
I mean,
do.
I would like to do it as well, but I don't know if we'd ever do it.
Like that.
Yeah.
Did Bjork do an album where it was just all her voice, you know?
Yeah, and Razelle, like beatboxing. Yeah.
I'd like to find a new instrument, you know, and just sort of work on something new that's just like going to make me think.
Yes.
I was thinking lap steel or something.
Okay. Lap steel and sax.
I picked up this bridge. It's got a bridge. I don't know what it is now. It's like Passerelle bridge.
What's that?
I don't know. It's this new bridge, and you put it in your guitar, and you put it on like 16th fret, and it basically turns your guitar into like a koto.
No. Oh.
So I'm going to play with that next.
Oh, wow.
Just finding something like a new thing that I can sort of sink my teeth in and feel like I don't know what I'm doing again.
Yeah. That's not a modular and it's not a synth.
Exactly.
It's Steve Reich, isn't it? He's like, oh, I don't mess with synths because they just sound very similar. They don't have, you know, hit an organic membrane or something. It's going to sound different every single time.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but you can, you and I both know you can patch it to make it sound
like,
different every
try
time.
Try harder, Steve. Like, yeah. Shit, since. Don't put that on me. Your hang-ups. Final question is, what is the future? Oh, this is like a music technology podcast, really, in effect, but it isn't also about writing music. But what do you want to be the future of music technology?
I mean, I would really like to own a door.
Yeah.
That just works.
Oh my God, no chance.
Yeah, I just like to turn on my computer and not have some problem.
An update.
Like Ableton's great, but I don't want warp engaged.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I want it off all the time.
I think you can say
well, off. Make you we should make our own one.
When you record into Ableton, when you record, it automatically just puts it on. So you have to continually go in and turn it off.
Does it? You can turn auto warping off.
To auto warp off. I'm talking about when you record in. Yeah. It kind of puts it into whatever your kind of default setting is. And it says, I mean, this is so boring now.
This is really bugged at me.
This is so annoying. Me and Tom are dealing with phase aligning, you know, process drums through modular with the real drums. And so if I were to send something out from Ableton to him, if warp was on, even though it wasn't complex, they say that if it's not complex, it shouldn't be on. If warp is on at all, then Ableton just like stretches everything. So by the end of the track, you're just like slightly out. It's different every time you turn the computer on. So it's just annoying. I just want it like some sort of AI door that knows what you need and just gives you what you need and keep it simple.
Sooner or later, it's just going to be like, you turn on Ableton, it's just a chat GPT prompt, right? It's just like, what music do you want today?
Yeah, well, I just want it to be, I like things that are simple and they work. Like, I like my workflow to be like, you know, just totally uninterrupted and quick. I like to be able to come in and just press a few buttons and then everything's just on and I'm off.
So flawlessness.
Yeah.
Flawlessness or simplicity.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're describing those like old... like Sadie or whatever, those really old, like, you know, the old disc systems didn't really do anything except just record and
I know.
Play back. Maybe that's what you need. I don't know. Maybe. ADAT.
That would be awesome, actually.
I mean, people had that right.
Or DAT tapes, yeah.
What about you, John? What, I mean, do you want technology or what, if you could invent a tool or what do you dream of?
No, I think anything I would want, we've already got. AI music doesn't excite me very much, but I don't think it's like the devil's music either. I think if people want it, then they'll take it. The same way we always do stuff. If people end up listening to AI music and not caring about that, then so be it. You can't deny your emotional response to something, and that's all we want at the end of the day is to feel something.
Yeah, I don't think humans are ever gonna want to get away from like an artist and, you know, a story.
No, I don't think so either. But I also think that AI, all it's really doing is bringing together a greater number of artists than you can hold in your head and recombining what they've already done into something else that a human could also do. And yeah, I don't really like the idea of not a person not creating it, but if you put the music in front of me and I didn't have that knowledge,
I wouldn't be able
to tell. Mm. And I don't think generations below us will be able to tell or will care. Especially when it starts getting into the realms of being personally tailored to the self, and you can get songs instantly written like that are about your actual life rather than just relating to somebody. Like, you are the star and the song is about the guy you fancy at school or whatever. That's going to be something we couldn't predict, because I can't do that for every 12-year-old girl in the world, can I? It would take too long, but it's perfectly feasible.
So that's a mission for you, John. That's the next album.
Well, it was a mission for Elvis. It was a mission for everyone that's come before. How many people can you get to relate to this without making the music really shit? And an AI can do that, unfortunately.
And that's why we made a record called Mountainhead.
That appeals. That should appeal to like nearly the entire world, as long as they understand what it's about.
Ha! yes, indeed. Mountainhead, it's out now. You should get this record. In fact, you should almost certainly buy it if you have the means. That will help support the band enormously. And go and see them play. I saw them last night at the Brudenell Social Club. They were excellent. And it was extra interesting seeing them play after having had that conversation that we just heard with them. Because I was watching Pete. Alex mentioned Pete, who is like the fifth sort of Beatle on stage, because it's a four-piece, but there are five people on stage. And Pete is amazing, amazing. He had a laptop and controller keyboards, and he had a synth and I think another keyboard. Pete was doing all of the other elements that make these songs work, you know? The little like distant past kind of little voices and things that all these like spot effects, all of these moments, and then layered components. Like there's parts where Alex will play the guitar and Pete is playing with him perfectly because, as Alex said, there are a number of sounds that are hybridized. It's guitar mixed with synth, and they do that on stage in real time, which is very non-trivial. And his timing is outrageously good. He was like absolutely on it. I was very impressed because, as I said, I've actually done this job not to anywhere near the extent and complexity that everything song is, obviously. But, you know, I've been the sort of, for a band that wrote a load of synthy parts and are like, oh, crap, how do we play these live? Because we've all got our hands full. Well, then you need another person that will just somehow magically translate it. And you have to make a sort of creative decision. Are we just going to play stems, or are they going to trigger those sounds and play the little riffs? And, you know, you can make it as easy or hard for yourself as you want. And what I noted was that Pete has made it quite hard for himself, I think, from what I saw him doing. He reminded me a bit of like Animal from Sesame Street at certain points, where he was like absolutely like ruling it. It's interesting as well to see the whole monitoring thing on stage. You can see that they're all wearing in-ear monitors. So they're all playing to this click track, and that is helping them be in time, hit those points, and John, more than anything, to sing. It is amazing what he is able to do with his voice. Incredible. So I really enjoyed the show. And if you get the chance to see them play, you absolutely should. Go and see them. They're touring at the moment. And think on these moments. Yeah, like there's a lot of like little bits and bobs of trying to understand their process that I will dwell on there. Not least Alex's efforts to make the modular useful in a music production standpoint, because if you have or do not have a modular synth, as these like big things that were behind us that Alex has, I can tell you that modular synths are amazingly powerful, but that they are really like, they are basically a place that you go to distract yourself and not produce music. That's a hot take alert right there. And it was interesting to see that his approach is to effectively use them as really complex processes, and especially to write the music first in simplistic ways. You know, like John's using basic sounds and tools, because at the end of the day, if you have a crap song, you can't make a crap song into an amazing song with cool sounding modular synths. You literally have to write a good song, and then you have the luxury of firing up a modular synth. And because you know what it is that you're going to capture, you hope that you get less distracted by the process of patching a modular synth. They would record guitars and then run them through the modular synth to place them in space, to move them around using stereo filters and other tricks to kind of create, to spatialize and enhance acoustic instruments. That's an interesting hybrid. And it's really non-obvious. You have no idea that really listening to the record that that's what they'd done, but that's what they'd done. The whole thing of putting like the loop brace over the transition, meaning that, you know, in if you don't make music, you have a brace that's like a sort of start and end point, and you can push a button so that the playback will just loop around the start and end point. And just placing that over the transition to listen to how the, you know, it goes from one section to the next is an interesting idea. One thing I didn't say at that time and it occurs to me later is just that can be misleading, because if you listen to the same little section in isolation over and over and over, it becomes its own little island of music. And you can sort of blind side yourself because you've missed the context of what has led up to it and what happens afterwards. I interviewed Colin Newman from the band Wire once, and he said a really bonkers thing about how he makes music, which is that he doesn't use the loop brace and that he does long, long takes from start to finish. You know, when he's going to record a part, he hits record with the like cursor placed at the start of the song, and he waits, the whole song plays until his part is due to come in, and then he adds his part from that point so that he has the whole context of the song. However, what makes me laugh is that that would lead to fuckos, because you end up listening to that little loop in isolation. Your context reframes, and then you probably add loads of things thinking, oh, that sounds amazing. But, you know, really what you're doing is creating techno because you're listening to the same one bar loop anyway. And then suddenly 4 hours later, you've done a fucko and you've created a like reggae version of your track, and when actually it doesn't fit anything around it. Which isn't obviously to say what Alex is saying is wrong. Of course it's not. Only that it's hard. It's actually hard in many respects to do that because you lose the context of the whole song. And I also like this whole thing of exploring something that you don't know, teaching yourself a device or some piece of technology, because the benefit is that because you won't know what you're doing with it, you won't be able to bring your old melodic habits to it. You'll have to, you'll like almost have your hands slightly tied behind your back. So you'll have to be using your ears more and clinging to what music you do get from it, which will probably be something slightly weird and different to what you would write. Because, you know, if you're used to playing a keyboard, or in Alex's case, if you're used to playing guitar, like your hands move in certain ways and places. They'll go to certain chords and then from those chords to other ones. Whereas if you use a mono teletype, which is this thing, basically the teletype is like a little mini computer that goes in a modular and you can type code. And Alex is a proponent of the teletype. And after our conversation, when we stopped recording, Alex, I was like, right, come on, show me the teletype, because we talked a bit about it. And he's a big into it. It's like you write little scripts, little bits of code, like a very simple language, and those little bits of code kind of do things like fire off events in your modular synth, make melodies. And it's kind of interesting in its abstract nature. And I think it's a perfect example of what he meant. You know, you are learning some weird abstract language and you're tinkering away and you peck at the thing and you hit enter and listen back to what happens. And you obviously don't understand enough about a teletype to be able to completely realize a dream. You're learning maybe a few commands at first, and it's just about what can I squeeze from them in that moment. And it's gratifying that he gets good results for it. I mean, there is a track called Teletype, an Everything track, and it's named after that device. And interestingly, if you are modularly inclined or not, let me tell you about something that you might find interesting. There is a thing called VCV Rack, which is a free modular synth like software. And if you download VCV Rack and just Google VCV Rack, there is a teletype for it. There is a full, complete recreation of the teletype that Alex has, which you can run within VCV Rack yourself right now. VCVRack.com. And I would recommend getting teletype if you want to mess around. There is a learning curve, as with all things, worth learning. But I will link to the tutorial that Alex actually sent to me. It's like an example of like, this is a good starter tutorial. And I'll put links to other things that we discussed in this episode down below. So I'm conscious that there may be people listening to this who are not sort of into the modular realm. I'm also, my job, by the way, you've never met me before, but I'm a modular synth enabler. I'm here to help people get into modular synths by making YouTube videos primarily. But yeah, I want you to know about VCV Rack and the fact that you can try a teletype. So if you want to kind of mess around and like follow in Alex's footsteps, you definitely should. I pass this on as Alex has been basically trying to get me to buy a teletype now. And I am only able to resist to a limited extent. I don't take much convincing. Alex, John, thank you so much for your time in speaking to me. Thank you, Everything, for being excellent. Their album, Mountain Head, is out now. You can stream it, but I would encourage you to buy the thing. Buy a compact disc or a long playing a piece of wax and support the band as best you can. Help them carry on. Keep making more wicked albums for years to come. I have a Patreon if you'd like to support Why We Bleep. That is patreon.com/mylarmelodies. Please consider sponsoring on Patreon if you can. That is the absolute best way to support us. But please also tell your friends about this podcast if you enjoyed it. Let them know that is also the other best way and is free of charge. Go and see them play, listen to some music, and perhaps make some noodles and teletype. Make some weird riffs that you're outside your comfort zone and take you to places that you wouldn't musically go because you're using a bizarre piece of technology to do it. It's free. Something for a Sunday afternoon. There's a whole back catalogue of Why We Bleeps to listen to if you are so inclined. But for this one, that's it, friend. Thanks very much for listening. Bye.